Are you looking for ways to attract and retain private pay clients? Thrizer is a payment platform for therapists built to help clients automatically tap into their out-of-network benefits and save on therapy up front. Check out our special link, join.thrizer.com/modern therapist, and use the code modernTherapists to activate $2,500 in free payments with Thrizer.
Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY done with you training and done for you SEO options. So there is truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist and use the code modern therapist for a DIY course or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your consult for special offers.
You're listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide, where therapists live, breathe, and practice as human beings. To support you as a whole person and a therapist, here are your hosts, Kurt Widhelm and Katie Vernoy.
Welcome back, Modern Therapists. This is the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy. And through kind of all of our episodes, we meander through these discussions around what is best practices. And a lot of times we, as a field, refer to those as either a specific theory or a specific technique that's used, but there really does seem to be a couple of broader best practices that are kind of thematic throughout the entire treatment. And talking with us today about one of those is Kristen Martinez. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist, and really talking about the role of trauma-informed work. And I know in my experience that there is a lot of people who claim to be trauma-informed, but are potentially referring back to the specifics of a theory that they're working for and are not necessarily looking at the whole picture. So helping us through this conversation today, Kristen Martinez, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
We're really excited to have you as well. I know you and I have had conversations about trauma-informed workplaces, and you've also kind of renamed and reframed some of the stuff into person-centered management, which is super exciting to me. We're both leadership junkies, and we both really value employee engagement and connection and nurturance. And so to me, this is exciting because this is something where it's saying, hey, we can fix public mental health by really providing an opportunity for organizations to do the best practices. So before we jump into that, tell us who you are and what you're putting out into the world.
So I'm Kristen. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I do a lot of things. I own a group practice. I own a consulting, like Katie mentioned, I do consulting on person-centered management, which again is really trauma-informed business practice. And then the third thing is I work for a certain government agency doing reviews and kind of going into large community health organizations and helping them to improve their trauma-informed practice. And that's what I want to take into businesses, and anywhere I can get it, that's where I want it.
Yeah, I think it is relevant because I'm excited for our audience, because this is a therapist survival guide, like about kind of going into public mental health, because I think a lot of us might have stayed in more active public mental health roles if the environments had been more sustainable. But I think it's true. I think all workplaces can really be helpful, really be helped by trauma-informed practices, person-centered management. So maybe you can say a little bit more about what exactly person-centered management is.
Yeah, I think it first started when I was in the community mental health world as a therapist, and just realizing that we were treating our clients a certain way and giving them the trauma-informed approach. But at the same time, we weren't getting that same kind of treatment from the organization. So there were high expectations. We had high caseloads with high intensity clients. We were expected to work long hours, be on call 24/7, and then get yelled at because our documentation was late or whatever it was, just a lot of stress in the work environment. And that's kind of when it started. That's kind of when I was like, hey, wait a minute, why are we being encouraged to do this with our clients, and yet nobody's doing it with us? And so, especially as a mental health provider and in my growing experience going into supervisory roles and management roles, I learned that even more so a systemic issue was at play. And more than just on the low levels, but on the higher levels, there's this trickle-down effect that's happening. Because there's high stress up on the top, it's all coming down. And unfortunately, as therapists in community mental health, burned out therapists and high stress therapists turn into high stress burnt out supervisors who turn into managers, who turn into directors, who turn into executives. And so what happens is that it just, the problem just escalates and widens. And what are, we end up with high turnover rates, high burnout rates, therapists who are in their own mental health crises because of the stress at work.
I know both of you have a lot more experience in that community of mental health aspect than I do. So coming at this from kind of a novice or a very limited experience of looking at this, what is some of the simplest ways of introducing this into a community mental health environment?
I think that there's a couple of ways to introduce it. And one would be a lot of training for management, for leadership, for supervisors, just so that they can start to hear it and maybe feel relieved by it and maybe start implementing some of the more simple ideas of it, which is really just like trauma-informed care, just like most therapy, is identifying that the people who are in our organization are people and they come with lives and they come with a history. And that's the basis of this, is just remembering that people aren't numbers. People aren't machines.
To step back a little bit, because I think Kurt and I both have a little bit of understanding of trauma-informed care, trauma-informed workplaces, but I think a lot of our audience hear it as just the words trauma-informed, meaning like, oh, I've been trained in trauma. And so maybe you can give us a little primer on what trauma-informed actually means in this context.
So when we're looking at it from the organizational standpoint, it's really, I feel, for me, it's really the same as looking at trauma-informed care from the practice side. And for me, the most basic trauma-informed concept is remembering that people's behavior is not an island. It comes from somewhere. And so we need to start looking not at what's happening with behavior of people or what's wrong with them, but looking at where the behavior is coming from, which is 100% of the time, in my opinion, coming from something historical, trauma-related. And so that's exactly how this is looking at people, but within an organization. It's saying, let's look at the behavior right now, looking at are things on time, which is, I'm using that because it's just an easy example. Let's say you have someone whose work is always late. It's instead of saying this person's work is always late, it's stepping back and saying, why is this person's work always late? And having the relational conversations in the work environment that start to build that relationship with the people who are working around you. And if we have that relationship, then we start to move forward on how do we intervene? How do we use this person's strengths? And how do we help counteract their weaknesses? So I think it's therapy for the workplace, really.
I really like that as a concept. And I'm kind of thinking of this from somebody who might be entrenched in this system, but that just sounds like a lot of work. Because, you know, really to go across an agency and look at each individual person, and it's just easier for a manager to label somebody as a procrastinator than it is to intervene at this level. Or that might border too much into an HR issue if this really is something, and I might not be as a supervisor prepared for that. So as you talk with these different levels of agencies about implementing these kinds of things, how do you manage that conversation or that resistance around being able to treat people like people?
I think the number one thing is when an agency or somebody is looking for help in this area, there's something wrong. They're kind of in a rock and a hard place. And although they're resistant and don't want to hear it, it's kind of like, what have you tried? What has worked? What hasn't worked? And let me give you this idea of why it's not working. And I totally understand that this sounds like really complex. And I think because the language that we're using is very theoretical, right? It's ideas, it's abstract. Whereas in practice, it's really simple. It comes down to some things that I did while I was a supervisor in the community mental health intensive services trenches, was I made a list of like 10 different things that I was promising, which was like the small team that I was organizing. So it was about transparency. It was about saying what I mean to say, right? Being transparent, saying what I mean to say, taking responsibility. So if I said I was going to do something and didn't say it, then I would put myself out there and take responsibility that I didn't do it. the other thing that I promised them is that I would never talk about documentation or productivity within the confines of clinical supervision. Everything was separated, clear. I made a huge efforts to put appreciation out there for my people, which people are like, how do you appreciate people? And everybody does it differently. And I did it like 25 different ways on a regular basis. But really, in practice, they're not hard things. I mean, I was probably done appreciating and loving everybody and creating a better, good team by 12 o'clock noon.
I think for me, the things that I have taken from what you're saying, as well as the things when there was kind of this new push to do trauma-informed workplaces, is the concept of looking at the individual versus the cog in the machine. And I think that's so critical. I think to Kurt's point, when you look at an individual and you actually problem solve for them individually, you're more likely to solve the problem than just holding a standard and holding it over and over again. It's like, hey, you really need to hit productivity. You need to hit to productivity. You're not hitting productivity. Why aren't you hitting productivity? You got to hit productivity instead of saying, hey, we have this standard. Let's look at what's going on with your caseload. Let's look at your own, you know, personal style, that kind of stuff, and really identify what is keeping you from having an appropriate caseload or getting your notes done on time. Let's look at what your specific situation is. And that is connecting. It's going to be a better supervision session, of course. It's going to be a stronger solution because it's going to actually resonate for the person that you're working with. And so to me, it's actually less time and it's less complicated. And I think especially therapists who become supervisors and managers, this is more authentic for them rather than you must do this. You know, that doesn't feel right. I think that's, in my experience managing supervisors, it was the folks that did the best job are the ones who connected and identified what was going on with their supervisees versus the ones that all of a sudden became these crazy overlords that were like, you have to hit supervision. You know, like you have to do all of these standards and blah, blah, blah. Like, it was like they became like these lunatics that were trying to manage and they didn't really know how to do it. And so to me, I don't think it's actually more complicated. It's actually more organic. So I agree with you, Kristen. I think there's a lot there that can be very, very helpful. And so to me, bringing this into community mental health, bringing it into other workplaces just makes so much sense. So what do you see as the biggest problems in workplaces that don't incorporate trauma-informed care?
Burnout, especially looking at community mental health, the ones who aren't doing it, which is most of them, are having high levels of burnout and turnover. So you've got therapists mm-hmm. who can stay 6 months, I think especially in our intensive programs, but across the board, they end up staying around for 6 months and onto the next agency. I don't know how many therapists I've interviewed and looking at like, I'm going to call it their rap sheet. It's just like pages. Like, and you ask them like, well, what happened here? And they're like, oh, well, productivity was like 36 hours a week and I couldn't do it. And I'm like, well, probably because nobody can.
And yeah, nobody can do 36 hours a week.
Like 90% productivity? No. So I get it. And it's just over and over. They go in there with hope that this is my field and they're met with, you're a number, you can be easily replaced. Hey, there's a new graduating class coming out this year. So if you don't want to do it and you can't comply, the next new grad will be able to comply. And I think that especially hits home with licensed clinicians, right? I think for community mental health, it's just known as soon as you get a license, you're out because it's not valued. You are not valued. Your time's not valued. Your expertise is not valued. And why do it?
Thrizer is a payment platform designed for out-of-network therapy. As a therapist, you would use Thrizer to charge clients for sessions and collect your full rate up front. From the client's perspective, Thrizer links to their health plan, so insurance claims are automatically submitted for them upon every charge. From there, Thrizer manages the claims end-to-end so that your clients don't have to worry about manually submitting super bills or getting on calls with insurance. The best part? Thrizer allows clients to only pay their co-insurance portion for sessions, while Thrizer covers the rest of your fee and waits for reimbursement on their behalf.
They also offer you an instant benefits calculator for free, allowing you to provide upfront transparency to prospective clients on their out-of-network coverage. Therapists only pay a standard 3% credit card processing fee per session with no additional fees. Visit join.thriser.com/modern therapist to get started and use our promo code Modern Therapists to receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Does part of this come even in the way that we educate people entering into the field? And I say this as an educator and as somebody who's talking about trauma-informed care and trauma-informed workplaces, but this really does seem to be a gap across the different silos of our profession, that the left hand doesn't necessarily know what the right hand does, or it at least creates kind of this expectation of, hey, the right hand's going to burn you out, and that's just part of what the system is. If we're able to start changing this conversation even earlier in people's careers, how might we start introducing these concepts in the classroom?
I really like that question, and I think that there's a lot of different ways that it can start to be addressed early on. It took me a long time to realize that the expectation was this is community mental health and you're going to burn out, because that is the underlying theme. Just people know you go to community mental health, you're guaranteed to burn out. And it took me a long time to realize that, oh my God, community mental health equals burnout. So I think part of the conversation early on, or even in school, is starting to prepare people for what the expectations currently there are. This is what you can expect. And then also prepping them for how can you, despite what the agency who's over you does, how can you start to survive in that environment? Because that's what it is. At this point, it's survival.
You know, part of this is already seeping there, but I think that it's people who have burned out in these agencies before. And what students hear is, there's so much paperwork, and you see all of these really intense clients, and it's coming from kind of this burnt out, experienced, licensed person perspective that there does seem to potentially be a space for hope that I'm hoping out of this, that is really being able to shift that conversation of acknowledging the realities of it, but not putting at it with a pessimism.
Yeah, and I don't think that we should look at it with pessimism. I definitely think it's more like, and I think this goes not just for new therapists, but therapists overall, is that we really encourage individuals to have boundaries. And part of this is also being able to create our own boundaries and knowing that when you step into community mental health, it's okay to say no. It's okay to say at 13, 16 clients, if you're fine with your hours, I don't need that client, nor will I take it. So it's just being able to prepare students going out of school that it's okay to have boundaries and it's okay to say no.
And I think that's the hardest thing. And that's the thing whenever I go and talk in classes and stuff about what community mental health is, I always say it's hard. There's a lot, but it's really powerful work and it's really good training, especially if you can find an agency that has either some of the tenets of trauma-informed practices or some of the goals of sustaining and maintaining their staff and nurturing their staff. Because I think that there are agencies that have really solid programs and really solid intentions. Maybe they don't have the resources or the time or the expertise to completely put these in place. But there's a lot of agencies that are really focusing in on, we need to have clinicians who stay. We need to have these clinicians stay at least 2 years post-licensure so we can help elevate them into the clinical supervision positions. We have to become competitive with Kaiser so that all our licensed clinicians aren't just leaving and going to Kaiser. We have to figure out how we can actually create a sustainable program so that the community members can actually still get services. Because when you have brand new people that are constantly turning over and they're brand new clinicians, you're not able to have the same caseload as if you have sustained clinicians. And so I'm seeing this going through, but I think as an educational system, because you don't have control over it, so kind of speaking to your question, Kurt, we have to teach clinicians how to set limits, how to choose where they work. And obviously there's, you know, a limited number of jobs and limited number of places and that kind of stuff. And so there's going to be choices. But I think people being able to identify this agency, this treatment center, this group practice, whatever, has these minimum level of requirements for me to sign on. And this is how I'm going to then take control over my aspect of my employment by setting the end of my workday, making sure that I'm clear on expectations, making sure that I'm asking for help when I'm not meeting those expectations, and making sure that at the very least, I'm setting boundaries when I need to, or seeking help to prioritize and understand how it's supposed to work. Because I think the piece that gets really dangerous is when the productivity standards or the caseload standards are created not based on a human being. Maybe it's on like the strongest clinician's strongest day, and so it's not a sustainable standard, but sometimes it's just based on this is what we need to have for our budget. And that doesn't actually work in real life. And so I think, you know, management, supervisors, those folks need to do some work too. But I think for folks coming in, it can be a very meaningful career. It's just, you have to make sure that you're really looking at the agency and how you set your own boundaries in it. So absolutely, Kurt, I think we do need to make sure that we put some hope out there, because these systems are so needed and so powerful.
And I think going off of that, not only about going into community mental health, but a lot of times when you get into community mental health, you're siloed. You're only around other community mental health providers. And so you start to absorb what's going on overall, right?
That kind of a toxic energy in some places too.
And I think one of the most helpful and biggest things for me was realizing that there's a world of clinicians outside of community mental health that can help you to realize that there's boundaries, that it's okay to say, mm-hmm. I can't do more than 16 client hours. But we need to start teaching our students that these places exist, that there's places that they can commune and not just be like, talk to your supervisor or clinical supervision. There's other things that students could be doing and connecting with and networking with other therapists in the broader community.
And this is where hanging out with therapists across the duration of my career is, there's kind of that mindset. And even in going to a number of networking meetings and having places where not being a part of that culture, I don't see people coming from that community mental health culture coming to these networking events because they're setting those boundaries of like, hey, I'm getting completely out of this therapy space. I'm going to go and do whatever it is that I do on my time. That really continues to contribute to that silo, that isolation that you're talking about here.
Yeah, because by the time they're done with their day, you're so drained from your work, and not to mention the 25 hours of paperwork that you still have to do. But they're just so drained that they want to go have a drink with their friends and they don't want to talk about anything that has to do with therapy. I think you're right on. And perhaps some of this, again, I think most of the responsibility is falling on to community mental health agencies and any organization, really. The bulk of the responsibility is on them to allow time for therapists to go and do this. So if you're in community mental health, you should be being allowed as part of your workday to being engaged with other therapists. It's just good practice.
Well, and I think it's something where it's required in a lot of ways. I mean, supervision is great, but there's also, you know, unless you can grab that supervisor who may have 8 or 10 clinicians that they're supervising, they have a group supervision, and then they also have progress notes to sign and chart reviews, and maybe they're also seeing their own caseload. Like, if you don't have access to someone to process some of the vicarious trauma or some of the other pieces that are going on, then you're going to end up with a lot of compassion fatigue and burnout. And so clinicians need that time. That's another part of the trauma-informed workplace, is being able to have that self-care folded into the workday, not penalized because it's not billable. And I think that's the part that's really hard, is that there's really tight budgets, especially since some of the financial changes that happened around 2008, where really being able to have the breathing room and the processing time to interact with other clinicians in helpful ways and to process your own stuff just went away. And so to me, I think there's a lot that we could talk about related to community mental health. I think that system is so big, and we can take it on, and we can keep trying to take it on and helping them to learn some of these things and teach them how to do those things. But I think the people who are listening to this podcast are probably group practice owners or clinicians who are entering into private practice or who are entering into the field for the beginning time. And so looking at, you know, kind of group practice owners or sole practitioners, how can they involve themselves or kind of incorporate some of these in trauma-informed practices? Because I think even as when I went from community mental health to my own private practice, I was the same boss. And so how do we, like, what are the things that we need to make sure we're doing in creating our own workplace or in the workplace for our supervisees?
Yeah, I think that's funny. I hear a lot of times group practice owners or just business owners in general say, I'm my own worst boss. And one, if you're in solo practice, is starting to take trauma-informed thoughts and ideas, not just applying to your clients, but apply them to yourself. Realize that you are a person, not a machine. You probably cannot see 35 clients in a week, let alone some clinicians who are seeing like 50 in private practice.
Oh my goodness, that's just ridiculous.
So remembering I'm not a machine, and then what kinds of things do I need? I need to network to make sure that somebody has eyes on me and making sure that I'm okay as a clinician, but then too, making sure we're taking self-care times, doing things that we love, doing things that are not work-related, taking a walk with your dog, whatever. You know, this. So it's kind of like take the same stuff you tell your clients and do it yourself. You know, make sure you're in therapy. If that's, I personally think that every therapist should be in therapy pretty consistently.
Me too.
Yeah. Yes. Consistently, if not all the time, should always be in therapy. So those are the basic things for solo practice owners. And then also, which I think is a huge part of it, is make sure that if you can outsource things that you don't like to do, outsource them. Why are you going to sit at your desk doing things that you hate to do when you could easily have somebody else do it for probably, you know, you could make $180, $200 an hour, while someone else you could pay $15 an hour to do the thing that you hate.
Yeah.
Which contributes to burnout. So it's really looking at yourself and saying, how do I treat myself like I'm a person who deserves the life that they have?
Yeah. And honoring your own expertise and some of the stuff your others saying. Yeah. I think my question, because are you a group practice owner too? Or
I do, yes. Okay. I own a group practice.
No, so I'm going to jump on this.
Okay. Go for it.
How do you put your money where your mouth is in your group practice?
I love it. I love my people. If you follow me, if you're a friend of mine on Facebook, you'll see the people, my people, I call them my people. They're always giving me shout outs. So I'm just saying.
All right.
Yeah. So how do I do that? One, my people are remote workers. I am not interested in having people sit in an office or at a desk when they don't have to be. Everything's remote. We do a lot of like Slack. We have a lot of team building, especially like we're pretty much all millennials. So we do Slack, but there's like a lot of hashtagging and a lot of jokes that we're throwing around with each other. The other thing is I have individual relationships with every single one of my therapists. I know what's going on in their life. I know what stresses them out. I know what they're okay to work with, what they're not okay to work with, what their expertise is. I know how they like to feel loved. I know so much about them. And they probably know equally as much about me. So the relationship is there. It's just something I believe in. Not only that, but making sure when my people are sick that I'm telling them like, hey, take today off and like tomorrow. And if you need like three more days, their caseloads, they will not go over 20. I don't feel comfortable with any of my people having more than 20-person caseloads of consistent clients. And I pay them good. I really believe in paying therapists their worth. And you work for me, our fee is $185. I pay them $80 per clinical hour, which in my area, most licensed clinicians and group practices are getting paid about $40 an hour. So I think that paying clinicians what they're worth is a big part of this too.
I love that.
Oh, and I pay, yes, and their training. All their training gets paid for. Anything they want to do, anything they want to be an expert in, I go ahead and I send them to do those things.
I love all of the points that you're bringing up. And just as, you know, kind of taking this even one step earlier, when you're onboarding new therapists into your practice, how much of this trauma-informed workplace conversation are you having from the very beginning?
Yeah. So far I've been lucky that most of the people who've come to me kind of either know people I know or I know them. I know them, so they know what I do. And they know that trauma-informed everything is just, for me, I should take my own advice on not doing everything work-related, but I'm 24/7 trauma-informed. I'm always talking about it. I'm always aware of it. And I'm always looking at them and saying, hey, have you thought about this being something that's an issue for you? Or have you, wow, you've been here a lot lately. Is everything okay? Or just from the get-go, it's just right away. It is. It's immediate.
I'm just imagining walking behind you in, you know, after being hired and just seeing Kristen point to like, that's a trauma, that's a trauma, that's a trauma.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, that's pretty much, that's really funny. Yes, I don't know what else to say.
Simplified SEO Consulting's team of mental health professionals genuinely want to help you attract more of your ideal clients with a proven on-page SEO process using the strategies that are most effective for therapist websites. They know SEO is an investment, which is why it is so important to find someone who aligns with your values and understands the importance of building your private practice in a meaningful way. Simplified SEO Consulting hopes to be that team for you and your practice.
The expert team would love to talk with you during a free consultation to figure out the best fit for your SEO journey. Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there's truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Be sure to ask if their innovative content network is a good fit for your website. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off a DIY SEO course with code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off your done-for-you SEO program onboarding this spring.
Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern-therapist.
And I think to me, the pieces that you've not mentioned yet that I think are really important for trauma-informed care is just recognizing that not just clients have traumas, therapists have traumas. If you have like a receptionist, they could have traumas, and really being aware of how all the different aspects of your workplace could impact that, could trigger people, and really being able to have the space to either change things and making the workplace itself more trauma-friendly, or having the space to process those things. The question we ask everyone, and I want to ask you this, okay, because I think you have a strong opinion about this. What do therapists typically get wrong?
So I think from the clinical perspective, a lot of therapists are still highly focused on behavior and looking at what is happening, what is going on, like what are people doing versus the underlying causes of those things. And the more we focus on symptom reduction, the more we're just putting band-aids on things. We are guaranteeing people coming back into therapy, which might be good for business, but it's not good for people. And I don't know how true that is, because I've addressed my own trauma and treatment, and I love therapy, but I'm a therapist. But we're really doing a disservice if we continue to just put band-aids on people and can make people continue to think that this symptom is isolated from this other thing that happened to me.
I want to go back to a point that Katie made just a couple of minutes ago and really applaud those kind of work environments that do trauma-informed training for all staff and not just clinicians, the secretaries, the admin support, that seeing this recognized from the moment that a client is looking at a website all the way through their entrance through the waiting room, all the way back if it's a higher level of care of the other kinds of staff that are really looking at how all of this kind of trauma impacts somebody. And that it's not just the responsibility of the clinicians, but that this is an entire team approach. And I know that there's a lot of places that do some aspects of this, but this really is kind of the efforts of best practices as far as of working with people and working with people in this trauma-informed environment. So it is something that's not just responsibility of the clinicians. And I really do applaud those places who take it to that level of seriousness.
I agree. And there's not a lot of them, but it is starting to happen. When I was in intensive mental health and we were supervising, managing, we saw a real need because a lot of that is interdisciplinary teams. And a lot of what was happening is that one, the therapist would be the holder of knowledge, and which would piss everybody else off. And then two, like the contact that was happening between a lot of the professionals and the families that they were working with wasn't trauma informed. And so there was really a push, at least on my part, was that every training that was for the clinicians, every single staff would attend. Whether they understood it or not, they were going to start getting exposed to the language of trauma informed care and what therapy is and the whole process. And then incorporating it into their supervisions as well. Like, hey, what do you think about the trauma of this? How do you think you can contribute to improving it? Or what's your take? And really starting those conversations around trauma. And I agree. It's really something that all staff needs to get trained on.
And I think all staff need to be taken care of as well. Because I think sometimes within systems, when everybody's really overwhelmed, they end up with, you know, kind of the crap running downhill. And so then the frontline staff and the frontline admin staff are getting crapped on because everybody's so overwhelmed. And so understanding that at every single stage, we need to be taking care of people and understanding that they're all people and all equally valuable to the team.
Yeah, it reminds me when I was working somewhere and there was an admin staff who ended up getting, I forget what it's called, but where half of your body goes paralyzed.
Bell's palsy,
which was stress and work related. And it's exactly because of that, because there was so much stress from the clinicians, they would end up passing it on to them like, oh, I need this, I need that. Or just the way they treat each other. Yeah. Turns out it's just ugly. The gossip, the nasty stares, the silent treatments that start happening because like you said, it's just a trickle down. And a lot of times the admin staff, okay, it even went down to the maintenance person. Mm-hmm. Like people would take it out on them, yell at them about a spill. It was just totally unhelpful.
Well, I mean, I think if you're treated like a machine or an object, you start treating other people that way as well. And it just keeps, you know, it's kind of when you're bullied, you bully someone else. I mean, it could kind of, it. So that I think what we're really saying is that when you can't or don't implement some of these person-centered or trauma-informed practices, that you really end up with a really toxic work environment that can treat all of the staff and potentially the clients, which is actually really bad for business, you know, to put a business spin on it. But you can, everybody gets treated really poorly and the environment is so toxic that it isn't doing the work that the mission is suggesting that we do.
Our guest today is Kristen Martinez. Where can people find out more about you and your practice?
So if you want to check out my consulting, I'm www.kristin-martinez-consulting.com. Or you can check out my group practice, www.paxtherapy.com.
And we'll include links to those in our show notes. You can find that at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also find Kristen at the Therapy Reimagined 2019 conference. She's one of our fabulous speakers. And we're going to have 2 days, October 18th and 19th, with all sorts of the fun that we bring to the conference space. We're bringing the serious, we're bringing the fun. We're fun about our serious, we're serious about our fun. So that is all made possible in part by Simple Practice. And until next time, I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy and Kristen Martinez.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. Learn more about who we are and what we do at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes.
Remember to check out Thrizer. They are passionate about making out-of-network therapy work for everyone. Clients save upfront on therapy while therapists earn their full rate. Get started in minutes on join.thrizer.com/modern therapist and use the promo code Modern Therapists and receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Don't forget, we have some special offers from our partner, Simplified SEO Consulting. Get 20% off a DIY SEO course with the code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off of your onboarding to the Done For You SEO program. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.